It is my pleasure to introduce to you Ayan Hirsi Ali. Ayan is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and author of Nomad, From Islam to America, A Personal Journey Through the Clash of Civilizations. Born in Somalia, Ayan lived in Saudi Arabia, Ethiopia, Kenya, before seeking political asylum in the Netherlands. She served in the Dutch Parliament for 3 years, where she focused on furthering the integration of non-Western immigrants and defending the rights of women in Dutch Muslim society. Her life changed drastically in 2004, when she collaborated with director Theo van Gogh on a film about the oppression of women in conservative Islamic societies. After the film aired, director van Gogh was assassinated, and Ayan was forced into hiding after receiving numerous death threats. Despite her life being threatened, Ayan continued her work as an advocate for social and political issues surrounding women's rights, tolerance, and multiculturalism. In 2007, she established the AHA Foundation to help protect and defend the rights of women in the West against militant Islam. The best-selling author of A Caged Virgin and Infidel, Ayan has been awarded the Norway Human Rights Bellwether of the Year Award, the Denmark Freedom Prize, Sweden's Democracy Prize, and the Moral Courage Award, which recognized her continued commitment to conflict resolution, ethics, and of course, world citizenship. Noted journalist Christopher Hitchens has said, "For me, the three most beautiful words in the emerging language of secular resistance to tyranny are Ayan Hirsi Ali."
No, I never say Muslims in general. I say Islam. Yeah. And I think it's important in trying to think about it. I'm paid to think, or at least to pretend, I think. But when you think about these things, then you have a language, and in that language you draw constructs and concepts. And so what I try to do is separate Muslims from Islam, which you obviously can do in theory, even though in practice that's a little more difficult. But in theory, a Muslim is an individual, a man, a woman, of whatever ethnicity, speaks a different language. There's a lot of diversity among Muslims. There are 1.5 to 1.7 billion Muslims, 1.5 to 1.7 different minds. When you take Islamic theology, the Quran, the Hadith, as left behind, that's the theology. Now, if the question you just asked me is there anything you appreciate in the Quran and the Hadith, I'll say, just like Bernard Lewis, who's looked into it, the initial part, the revelations in Mecca, that were all preaching peace and tolerance and unity and taking care of orphans, all of that is great. What comes after that, when Muhammad goes to Medina, has a large enough army, and then goes on from being spiritual to being a conqueror? That's what I reject. And when people ask me, do you think that Islam can be reformed?
I was just going to ask you that.
Exactly. Reformation. First of all, if you use the word reform, you're assuming there is something wrong. Something has to be corrected. Something has to be fixed. Mm-hmm. And what needs to be fixed, in my view, is to have all the revelation that comes after Medina to be deleted.
Mm-hmm. So, and the hadith as well.
And the hadith. The hadith, in fact, most of the hadith, because the hadith is, the hadith also goes, the problem with the hadith is it also goes into detail. Mm-hmm. It starts to spell out how much of the female skin should be covered. Now, that's not a religion, that's totalitarianism.
And Muhammad, we don't know if Muhammad even said any of those things.
In fact, we don't even know if Muhammad existed.
Yeah, you know, this is true.
We don't know.
He was, yeah.
We don't know because there are researchers who are saying he may or he may not have existed. There is a hypothesis that he may not have existed.
Oh, really?
And it's clamped down on with threats and so on. And so then you never get to the truth. There are people who hypothesize that Jesus may not have existed. Mm-hmm. But that's no problem. So if you really believe that he existed, then it becomes academic. It really doesn't become a life-threatening matter. To me, the question, did Muhammad exist or did he not exist, is academic. What is not academic are individual human beings living right now saying, I'm going to marry a 9-year-old or a 14-year-old. I'm going to participate in killing other people because Muhammad told me to. And then Muhammad exists. It's like a self-fulfilling prophecy. It doesn't matter, even if he never exists, but those ideas exist. And then it's worth exploring those ideas. And if you say, is there anything right about Islam? I would say those Meccan chapters, when the founder of the religion, whether he existed or not, the founder of the religion, let's assume he did exist, was preaching just goodness and unity, take care of the orphans, be hospitable, be generous, universal goodness. And then after that, when he goes to Medina, that part has to be debated. He creates a civilization or he inspires a civilization. He inspires conquest. He inspires men to unite and fight for the sake of Allah. All of that has to be re-examined and I think shared. And so the average American Muslim who says, I want to adhere to the American Constitution, I want to be a patriotic American, and yet I want to call myself a Muslim, I would say, well, that means that you have to relinquish 3/4 of the Quran.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Banning the veil, do you advocate that?
I don't. And the reason, I think the veil is a restrictive, terrible symbol. It is, I mean, I can't condemn the veil enough. But banning it, in my view, is not the answer. I think the best thing to do is to have, in a Western society, the best thing to do is to have a debate about the substance. What does the veil stand for? What is the likelihood of Sharia law or parts of Sharia law being introduced, for instance, into Australian society? That is what the debate should be about. If you're going to have a debate about the presence of Islam in Australian society and you understand Islam as it is representing a religious dimension, which I think is fine, you can practice in a liberal democracy, you can have, you know, you can pray 5 times a day, you can fast, your foods, or go to Mecca one if you can afford it once in a year or whenever, that's all fine. That's the religious dimension of Islam. But Islam has 2 other dimensions. There's the political dimension where the concept of jihad and Sharia law is central, and there is a social dimension that governs the relationship between men and women. Now, if you want to start a debate about how does that social dimension and that political dimension fit into a liberal society like Australia, then you better have that debate and don't just have a debate about a very, very small symbol like the burqa or the face covering. Because if you do have the face, this is what's amazing about Australia. I come at a time when there are elections. People really want to have, the population wants to have a debate about culture and the clash of civilizations, and particularly the clash between Islamic values on the one hand and Australian values on the other hand. And the leadership, the politicians, are having a a cosmetic debate about immigration and about a big Australia and about a small Australia, but that's not what the debate is about. If you want to learn anything about Europe, what is it? What are the mistakes that Europe made? The mistakes that Europe made is exactly what you're seeing. They trivialized the debate. They talked about burqas, they talked about minarets, and they're caught in a quagmire of burqas and minarets. They're not talking about the substance. And the substance is that clash of values. And when you do have a clash of values, there is no compromise.
I think we ought to do a number of things. And the first step is to emancipate ourselves from the idea and from the inhibition that we can't criticize all the ideas and all the religions and all the beliefs in the world except Islam. That takes emancipation. When you look at the political correctness surrounding discussing the principles of Islam, you start to wonder, why Islam? If I were a Christian, I would be offended. I'm an atheist. I don't enjoy the same protection. So one step is, let's take Islam for what it is. It's a set of beliefs. And let's examine it. There are good things in there. There are things that are not so good but not so harmful, and there are terrible things in there. And all sorts of beliefs have that. Now, I understand the objection by many Muslims to say there are people who will use the criticism of Islam as an idea, as an excuse to hurt Muslim individuals, to discriminate against them, to abuse their rights or to violate their rights. And that's where the second step comes in. We have to protect the rights and freedoms of all individuals who live here, whether they are Muslim or not. By doing that, by protecting the Muslim individual, then we also take away from him the argument that Islam will only and can only be reformed and Islamic tenets can be addressed only after we've given a guarantee that all people are protected. I would rather give the priority to victims like Amina and Sarah. Then the third step would be to protect the rights of people who think out aloud. I met a young man here tonight, and I get emails from Muslim individuals who say, I relate to you, I don't agree with everything you say, but there's so many things that I agree with, and I want to come out and say these things, and I want to come out and publish them. And I can't, because I don't want to live like you. I don't want to be threatened, and I don't want to run the risk of being killed. That sentiment, and it's growing, should make you all worried, because that is hollowing out the roots of the rule of law. If a society cannot protect its citizens, if a society cannot protect the freedom of expression, then that society is going to collapse. Then it's going to be like all the other societies where Muslim immigrants are running away from. So I would say start to treat Islam as a basic, basically as any other idea, and protect the freedom of expression as we protect all, in order to safeguard the public arena where we can have a debate. And finally, and that's what my statement was, my lecture was about tonight, women's rights. The emancipation of the Muslim woman is the key to reforming Islam.
You encountered the Muslim Brotherhood in your youth. Today they are a major force in the Middle East as per Arab Spring. Do you think that they will lead a secular government as they say? What are your insights?
The Muslim Brotherhood is not going to lead a secular. Some of you may believe in miracles, and miracles happen. But I do not think that a movement that exists as its main mission to establish divine law, Sharia is divine law, is suddenly going to say, oh, you know what? Now that we are in power, we've changed our mind, we're going to go secular. They would not be credible. When I was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, what got me to become a member and all the people around me, and why it was so appealing, and the main, attraction, the cohesion, was about Allah, our God, It was about the Quran, our holy book. It was about the Prophet. It was about leading your life. Even if there was no Sharia state, the appeal was to live by Sharia law, by divine law. For since 1920, the Muslim Brotherhood was preaching this. Prominent members of the Muslim Brotherhood were dying for this, not only in Egypt, but everywhere where they were established. Just because they were able to overthrow the secular dictatorship, for them to say, oh, we're all going to go secular, or just to correct the economy. I don't believe that that is going to happen. I think it's a very good thing, not only in Egypt, but in the rest of the Arab world, that in the countries where they were able to throw off the dictatorship, I think that's a good thing. I think it is good for Egyptians to have the opportunity to vote, because Egyptians, individuals, answer the question, how would we like to govern ourselves? And I'm really passionate about this. And their answer is, we think that the Muslim Brotherhood, Sharia law is the answer, divine law, and I think that it's their privilege to try it out. Just like the Iranians in 1979, no one imposed divine law on the Iranians. They opted for it themselves. They've lived with it for over 30 years, and it's that kind of experience. And people are very pessimistic about Iran because of the nuclear war, but I am very optimistic about Iran because the Iranian population have lived by the consequences of their choice, which is Sharia law, and they regret it. And I would like the Egyptians to have that opportunity, and the Tunisians, and the Yemenites, and possibly even the Saudis. And it's only with that kind of maturity that I think that they can come to the conclusion it doesn't work. It's not going to help if outsiders go in there and say, you know, Sharia law is bad for you. It won't. You have to experience it yourself.
Ayaan, one of the most memorable things I remember in Infidel was when in Holland you finally took off your hijab and nobody raped me.
Yeah, no man jumped me. Yeah. You see, if you walk around without a hijab, you'll be jumped by men. So men are like animals. In fact, there was a famous imam here in Australia, Hillel or someone like that, who compared women to a piece of meat and men to, you know, these wild he-goats who, if they see a woman uncovered, will just jump her. So that came from somewhere. But yeah, it does fascinate me. I think after reading the Quran, you convert from whatever you are, you become a Muslim as a woman, you read the Quran, and maybe the first few days you feel a sense of focus and meditation and all that. But then after a while, you have to live and completely submit your will to a man who's supposed to take you whenever he likes. Your testimony is worth only half of his. He can beat you when he wants.
Not too hard
and all that. And so that is the part. It is the part, you know, what comes after that I think, whoa, this is a form of madness, to me at least.
But what we see in Europe, as far as the arrival of, you know, the side effects, if I may call it, is immigration. It's not just new immigration, but it's the presence of people, particularly from Muslim countries, who've been here 3 or 4 decades, who have trouble integrating, and we also see discrimination as an issue of the receiving society, at least perceived in discrimination, even if it's not real. We also see the presence of radical Islam in Europe, the UK, Germany, the Netherlands. How are we going to respond to that? It is organized and it uses the institutions of freedom and the vocabulary of freedom to destroy freedom. And the third factor that plays along with this is the European complacency that I referred to earlier, this sense of being invincible, the idea that, you know, people can just be here and these bad ideas can be spread. We don't have to bring about a counter-narrative. People who come here will, you know, it'll just take a bit of time, but they'll be like us. And I think that that is not a healthy attitude
toward that, given the numbers and given at the fast pace at which this is spreading. I want to end, and I want to end with a note for the students. And I want to say that I wish you all the best in your studies, and I wish you a great wisdom in your future as leaders when you're confronted not only with problems from the Middle East, but from China and Russia and other places. I thank you very much for your attention.